This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I missed my own introduction. I came to this topic and this paper in a somewhat roundabout way, a fact that is especially pleasing to me now that I find where I am. I've been writing recently about the historical charts of the 18th century English scientist and theologian Joseph Priestley. This is what you see behind me. Priestley made two of these charts in the 1760s. A chart of political history and a chart of biography. These are remarkable works, and there's plenty to say about them, but for today, I'm leaving all of that in parentheses. Through a series of happy accidents, I wound up finding two very curious artifacts related to these charts at just about the same time. Next slide, and one more. Okay. The first of these was a manuscript copy of Priestley's new chart of history, done in America about 1800 and now held at the Library Company of Philadelphia. The second was a description of the process of copying Priestley's history chart in a children's book that was published in England in 1819. To me, the account of the copying of the chart in the children's book was surprising. The book, Harry's Holiday, or The Doings of One Who Had Nothing to Do, by the noted children's author Jeffreys Taylor, is to all appearances a standard 19th century instructional fable. Its stated aim is to point out errors, and the book is full of errors, most of which are fairly easy to figure out, but not all, and I'll give you an example. One of the strange errors that our protagonist commits turns out to be making a manuscript copy of Joseph Priestley's new chart of history. This struck me as odd. Copying Priestley's history chart seems precisely the kind of exercise that a young boy studying history in 1819 might have been expected to do. Moreover, as the manuscript chart from Philadelphia shows us, it was in fact that somebody did do at least once. And we'll have the next one. Right across town in the library of the American Philosophical Society, you can see a copy of one of Priestley's smaller works. This one is his chart of biography of the patriarchs. As Taylor's narrator tells it in the children's book, in contriving to copy the chart, Harry made four errors. The first was willfulness. He had no real reason to want to do it. The second, impatience. He didn't take the time to do this delicate task properly. The third, lack of perseverance. When he got frustrated, he gave up. But the fourth is the most interesting of all. In choosing to copy this elaborate engraving by hand, Harry misconstrued the value of labor itself in an economy of mechanical reproduction. This was something of which Jeffreys Taylor, raised and homeschooled by an engraver, was keenly conscious. And it seems quite likely that Jeffreys, as a boy, was the one who innovated this particular error. In the story, Harry's father tries very hard to hold him off at the pass and to prevent him from even attempting this futile project. Quote, "It will cost you a great deal of labor and time to copy that neatly from beginning to end," Harry's father argues, "and when done, it would only be another of what we have already. It is something like copying a printed book, which would not be worthwhile, you know, because the time it would take must be more valuable than the money it would cost. And with respect to the operation of copying, I'm afraid you will find it very difficult to draw all the lines on the chart without a blot or an error, and I can assure you that it will be a very fatiguing task to write in all of the names." Of course, had Harry been able to carry his project through, his father might have admired his perseverance. Still, that's not the way the book plays it. In the view of Harry's father, taking up the chart in the first place is already a mistake, and it's only one example of the kind of misplaced energy that he finds himself constantly correcting in his dervish of a child. Harry's persistent error is not laziness or lack of industry in a simple sense. Rather, it is his roaming attention that renders all of his efforts idle. So this is a distinction that I'm making between laziness and something else. And in order to get why I think this distinction is important, I need to roll back the clock just a little bit. Speaking generally, we might identify two different approaches to the history of sloth. For want of better terms, I will call the first approach lazy and the second slothful. The first approach, the lazy approach, would ask what sloth means in our language and culture and how it functions in our system of values and so forth. These are good, legitimate, grounded questions, and they might help elucidate sloth as it is. A second approach, which I will call slothful, and this is what I'll opt for, would bracket the ordinary meaning of sloth in favor of an antiquated usage that may have some renewed utility today. To understand sloth in the sense that I propose, it's important to be precise about what we mean by the term. In contemporary English, we are blessed with an abundance of slothish words, and I think Sina and Aaron gave us an excellent summary of what that list might look like. But strictly speaking, sloth is not the same thing as any single one of these terms. Historically, sloth is a bipolar concept, signifying a dissatisfaction that may be equally expressed through immobility or restlessness. And it was precisely to capture this ambivalence that the term was originally adopted in Latin. In the Western tradition, the first important discussion of the concept of sloth occurs in the works of the 4th century monk Evagrius of Ponticus. The Latin term that Evagrius uses, which would several hundred years later be translated into English as sloth, is interesting in itself. The term is acedia, from the Greek for lack of care, and not, as the early modern etymologists would have it, from acidus, or sour. Prior to the generation of Evagrius, it had no usage in Latin. Apparently, Evagrius and his fellow monks found it important to distinguish between a simple, everyday carelessness or laziness, for which Latin, like English, had plenty of terms, and a more profound condition of uncaring, specifically relevant to the monastic context. It's worth pointing out parenthetically that in the 17th and 18th centuries, a similar kind of borrowing takes place when English writers adopt the word ennui from the French, not to designate everyday boredom, but a special, powerful, and general kind of boredom equivalent to a psychological or a moral condition. Indeed, in the 1770s, the London Observer remarked ruefully that the English nation had been fortunate up until that time to have gotten along without such a word. In Evagrius, acedia refers to the loss of joy in God, sometimes experienced by the ascetic, and to a consequent distraction from the contemplative experience. In his discussions, Evagrius is strikingly specific about how acedia, or the boredom of the cell, may be felt. For the ascetic, he says, it is a perturbation of the soul that is tightly wrapped up with the temporal regulation of monastic practice. I quote, "The demon of acedia," writes Evagrius, "is the most burdensome of all of the demons. It besets the monk at about the fourth hour in the morning," about 10 a.m., "encircling his soul until the eighth hour. First, it makes the sun seem to slow down or stop moving so that the day appears to be 50 hours long. Then it makes the monk keep looking out his window and forces him to go bounding out of his cell to examine the sun to see how much longer it is until 3 o'clock and to look round in all directions in case any of his brethren is there. Then it makes him hate the place and his way of life and all of his manual work. It makes him think that there is no charity left among the brethren and that no one is coming to visit him. For Evagrius, acedia was a specifically monastic problem, just as was at the time the regulated time schedule itself. And neither would become a general cultural concern for roughly another millennium. Evagrius related acedia to more mundane feelings, such as sadness and apathy, but also, as is clear in the passage that I've just quoted, to restlessness, impatience, and even hyperactivity. And throughout the Middle Ages, this constellation of feelings or symptoms was understood to characterize what in Latin was called acedia and what in English was referred to as sloth. In the Middle Ages, in the later Middle Ages, when sloth was canonized as one of the seven cardinal sins, it was this bipolar concept of sloth and not our weaker concept of laziness which was intended. During the later Middle Ages, the concept was finally dissociated from monastic practice and given a scientific explanation based on Aristotelian psychology. But even in this period, its typical expressions were still taken to include restlessness, verbosity, and unregulated curiosity, which was a special concern of Thomas Aquinas. It was not until the Renaissance that the notion of sloth became definitively associated with inactivity, whether spiritual or secular. And this was a radical transformation. Distraction, hyperactivity, and what we still call idle curiosity, all of these characteristics that Evagrius or Aquinas would have immediately associated with sloth increasingly seemed like its opposites. Next slide, please. In modern English, the term sloth gradually lost its linguistic pride of place and faded into a vague ambivalence with the wider semantic field. Of course, our language never lost its need for bipolar terms. In the Renaissance, some of the semantic slack left by the evacuation of sloth was picked up by the term melancholy. As Erwin Panofsky has shown, the connection can be drawn directly within the iconographic tradition. And so this is a medieval iconographic representation of acedia. And next. This is a Renaissance iconographic representation of melancholy. And you can go one more. And the same association underlies the 1514 engraving of Melancholia by Albrecht Dürer, and one more, and very likely also the Sleep of Reason by Goya, published in 1799. All of this, I think, helps us grasp the kind of conceptual and terminological difficulty faced by Jeffreys Taylor and by his contemporaries when moralizing on these subjects, and why their vocabularies of idleness and indolence seem awkward and misplaced. Nor did the cluster of ideas around industry and progress clarify matters at all. To the contrary, in the seemingly accelerated clock-conscious world of the 18th and 19th centuries, identifying problems related to unregulated activity seemed at least as important as identifying those related to indolence. One would, of course, be forgiven for wondering whether any of the Taylors of Ongar, Jeffreys, Isaac, Jane, Anne, or any of the others, actually knew anything about indolence in the first place, whether it even crossed their radar. To say that the Taylor family was industrious would understate the case considerably. Each generation of Taylors, beginning with Jeffreys' grandfather, a notable painter and engraver, and secretary of the English Society of the Arts, bore with great seriousness its moral and intellectual burdens, and above all, the responsibility for educating the generation to come. And if the end product is any indication, the child pupils among the Taylors regarded their part in the enterprise with equal gravity. In the years between 1814 and 1867, the Taylor clan was particularly active. During this period, the parents and the children together wrote and published at least 73 books, to say nothing of the scores of others for which they provided the original images. Though they published on many subjects, It was in the area of the intellectual and moral education of children that the Taylors were most prolific and innovative. They wrote poems and stories, textbooks and homilies, and many other works designed specifically for kids. And while their names may be forgotten now, their influence persists. Even today, it is probably the rare child in an Anglophone country who does not know at least one or two verses from the Taylors, such as those from the 1806 poem by Jane and Anne, which begins with the words, "Twinkle, twinkle, little star." The Taylors were innovators of targeted writing, work aimed specifically at an age group. Indeed, the first modern usage of the word teen was introduced by Isaac Taylor II in his 1818 conduct manual, Advice to the Teens, or Practical Helps Toward the Formation of One's Own Character. Thus, when Jeffreys Taylor set out to write Harry's Holiday, he was treading on well-known family ground. As the book begins, it is the 11th birthday of our protagonist, Henry Stapleton, or Harry to his friends. Harry is a smart, loyal, educated, imaginative, and energetic boy, but he is also something else, something that Jeffreys has trouble finding a name for. For his birthday, our smart, loyal, educated, imaginative, and energetic protagonist receives two gifts from his parents, reflective of both their affection and their aspirations for their son. From his father, Harry receives a beautiful little pocket watch, and from his mother, a copy of Samuel Johnson's Rasselas. This is all well and good, Harry thinks, a new watch particularly well and good. But an even better present would be the opportunity to get away from the incredibly well-meaning household of his parents altogether, to be liberated from the demands of his schedule that are always so pressing. Well, the way things go in children's books, wishes like Harry's usually get granted, and usually to terrible but instructive effect. And this is precisely what happens here. On reflection, Harry's loving, intentional, enlightened, experimentalist, and time-conscious parents find no reason to deny Harry his wish, at least for a period. Indeed, they see every reason in the world to grant it. To them, it appears a perfect opportunity to teach a lesson in something of value, the value of schedule, something, Harry's father notes, not easily done by words. So Harry and his parents do a deal. Harry will have a holiday for 1 week with no schedule, let the chips fall where they may. Well, as I've said, it's no great surprise what happens next. Harry gets himself into various instructive kinds of trouble. In rapid succession, he tries to do just about everything he can think of in order to amuse himself. As soon as he tires of one activity, he moves on to another. Not that garden variety laziness is altogether absent here, but Harry has much better ways to waste his time, and he has lots of them. In the course of his short holiday, he manages to waste his time renovating a rabbit cage, building an electrical machine, painting a wheelbarrow, and writing Aesop in verse. That's not all. He fiddles with his new watch, engages with experiments in optics, attends lectures, leads an expedition, flies a kite, and, oh yes, finds time to copy a chart of history. Of course, in the terms of the story, all of these activities really are supposed to seem like a waste of time. And not because they're intrinsically useless, but as we've seen with the chart, because Harry misunderstands their importance, misapplies his energies, and doesn't stick with any of them long enough to derive any value. He loses his rabbits, breaks the electrical equipment, wastes money on unused paint, gets his friends lost in the woods, and plots his chart on an uneven scale. And it's not that Harry doesn't know what's going on either. To the contrary, he finds the whole situation humiliating. His aim from the beginning is not to avoid anything, but to do everything in his own time, or to quote Harry directly, to prove that there is no need for so much bell ringing to tell me what to do or when to do it. The issues that concerned Jeffreys equally concerned the other authors in his family. In Advice to the Teens by Jeffreys' father, Isaac, for example, there's a wide search for an adequate vocabulary to discuss the specific sorts of distraction faced by an educated middle-class teenager. In Isaac's work, the key term is not laziness or indolence, but desultoriness. Desultory, of course, means disconnected or lacking in a definite plan. Charmingly, it comes from the Latin desultor, which means a circus performer who leaps from horse to horse, which itself derives from the Latin salire, to leap. The key developmental danger for the middle-class teen, as Isaac Taylor diagnoses it, is not that he or she may wish to do nothing, that it is that, a la Harry Stapleton, they may wish to do everything and everything all at once. The most influential of the Taylor's works in this regard was a very popular short story by Jane Taylor, the daughter of Isaac and the sister of Jeffreys, which takes up this familiar subject once again. In the story called Busy Idleness, Jane attempts finally to fix a name for the Harry Stapleton phenomenon. The shape of the story doesn't take much explaining. It reads very much like a girl's version of Harry's Holiday. In it, two sisters, Caroline and Charlotte Dawson, are left alone while their mother goes on a trip. When Mrs. Dawson returns, she finds that Caroline has done her homework and chores. Charlotte, on the other hand, has begun dozens of projects, reading Cowper, learning shorthand, organizing bookshelves, making a quilt, and has completed none of them. Like Harry, too, she tries her hand at versifying, attempting a history of England in rhyme, though, as the narrator notes, the epic stopped short some 100 years before the Norman conquest. For her good behavior, Caroline is rewarded with several gifts, a beautiful little watch chief among them. Since Charlotte has completed nothing, she receives a package of gifts from each of which her parents have cruelly removed a key component. She gets a fan without a fastening pin, a penknife without a blade, a telescope without a lens. Still, as the narrator says, Charlotte was greatly encouraged to discover that the last remaining article was a watch, for as she heard it tick, she felt no doubt that this at least was complete. But upon examination, she discovered that there was no hour hand, the minute hand alone pursuing its lonely and useless track. As I've already noted, Jane Taylor had a number of terms for Charlotte's disposition, but the key term in the story is the beautiful oxymoron that is announced in its title, Busy Idleness. Just as in the case of Harry Stapleton, what is at issue for Charlotte Dawson is not laziness. Charlotte is always busy. And this makes perfect sense according to the moral scheme laid out by Isaac. Those who do not manage their time can never repose. In fact, Jane's term, busy idleness, went on to a fine career in the later 19th century, briefly capturing something of the zeitgeist and appearing in the company of other modish words like ennui. Well, that time is, of course, still our time in some important ways. I'm sure that I don't need to point out to anyone here the feelings of frustration and emptiness, tristitia, to use the Latin from Aquinas, that we are all supposed to be experiencing in our compulsive email checking, web surfing, texting, and the rest of it. Nor do I need to emphasize the immensity of the growing pile of books, which is aimed at helping us address this condition. I would simply want to emphasize how little any of this busy idleness has, to do with unique 20th and 21st century developments, and how thoroughly it fits into a long-standing moralizing tradition. This tradition has not been static, and in fact, during the modern period, we find repeated, sometimes less and sometimes more successful improvisations aimed at restoring the valuable conceptual and linguistic ambivalence that was lost with the marginalization of sloth. Thank you.